You're listening to the Prepared Homestead Podcast, equipping you to build a self-sufficient homestead in uncertain times.
We're your hosts, Sean and Monica Mitzel, coming to you from Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm in the mountains of northern Idaho. We're glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, Monica and I get a chance to sit down with John Moody and talk about some food freedom issues, food sovereignty. And John Moody is the director at Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which their motto is basically defending the rights and broadening the freedoms of family farms and protecting consumer access to raw milk and nutrient-dense foods. John Moody, like I said, is the executive director of Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. He's a husband, father to four, small farmer, author, very dynamic speaker, and after serving on the board of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, he was asked to serve as interim executive director and now full executive director. John has participated in the small farming and food freedom movement in many ways over the years, serving as administrator for one of the largest local buying food clubs in the nation, standing up with the members of that buying club to unjust enforcement actions to deny people their access to real food, protesting the FDA's harassment of farmers and people seeking real food, and speaking across the nation on matters related to food, health, and farming. He is really good to talk to. He's very dynamic and certainly knows what's going on, has the pulse, and we've had him on the podcast before, and this time he's coming back to us to give us an update on what's happening. Let's talk to John Moody. Well, hey, John, thanks for being with us again, being on the podcast once again. For those that don't know you or what you do, would you please kind of go back, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to this point in your life?
Great. Well, I'm going to make it short, and if people want to hear more, there's some places on the internet and on our website to give a little more details. But had you met me about 20 years ago, you would have been willing to take a second mortgage out on your house, go to the local bookie, and bet all your money that you would never find me on a show like this today talking about the things we're going to talk about. I was your standard diet eating, video game playing, city boy, modern city boy you can imagine. And so I moved to Kentucky in 2000 to get my master's. And while I was working on my master's, I became really ill. I developed a condition known as duodenal ulcers. Mm. And the best way I can describe duodenal ulcers is imagine Snow White and the Seven Dwarves take up residence in your gastrointestinal tract.
Nice.
And the dwarves are given razor-sharp pickaxes, crack cocaine, and Metallica music.
Wow.
And it's just like unremitting pain, as if a group of wandering gnomes are ripping you apart from the inside out.
Okay.
It's just terrible. And so I went to a doctor, and the doctor, he looked at me and he said, "Hey, this is no big deal. This is happening to lots of people your age." And that right there didn't sit well with me. And he goes, "Hey, we'll just put you on this medication." I said, "Well, what does this medication do?" And he pulls out the insert on the medication, and it's like one of the old cartoons where they open the piece of paper, and it keeps opening until it hits the floor, and then the paper rolls across the floor. And the doctor has to get out a magnifying glass to read the 0.1 Times New Roman font. And he's like, this shuts off your body's ability to produce hydrochloric acid.
Oh.
And my first thought was, like, I'm an Avenger. Like, you know, there's Iron Man, there's the Hulk, and there's me. Like, because, you know, hydrochloric acid, like, that's amazing stuff, and I make hydrochloric acid. But my next thought was, like, if my body makes hydrochloric acid, it's probably not good to have my body stop making hydrochloric acid.
Right.
And I posed that question to my doctor, and he had no good answer.
Hmm.
And so I left that appointment. And I started on the medication because I was just in such bad shape, I had to do something. But at the same time, I began to question what I was eating and where it was coming from.
Hmm.
And within a year, by changing where we shopped and who we got food from and how we prepared it, I was able to completely heal my duodenal ulcers. I had seasonal allergies so bad growing up that Benadryl sent me free stock options. And I now live in the Ohio River Valley, one of the top five places in the nation for allergies. I have a brother and sister who are asthmatic, and I have no seasonal allergies at all anymore.
Nice.
Let thy food be thy medicine.
I have no dental decay. I had dental caries and all kinds of dental problems growing up that I have none of anymore.
Awesome.
And so we started to reform the way we ate and where we got food from. We started a local food buying club because we wanted to make sure the people we were getting our food from were raising it in ways we approved of. And we also wanted to make sure they were getting the lion's share of our money when we were paying for this food, because we realized very quickly that Whole Paycheck and a lot of these other grocery stores are selling things that masquerade as healthy and natural and organic, and will charge you an arm and a leg for them while giving the farmer a penny.
Yes.
And so we started this local food buying club, and we were raided by the Kentucky State Health Department.
Oh, wow.
So they showed up at our buying club. They served us cease and desist orders. They served us a quarantine order with the whole, you break this quarantine, you go to jail threat and all that kind of stuff. And up until this point in the government's war on small farmers and real food, every other group in the nation had lost when something like this had happened.
Hmm.
So you probably have heard about the raids in California.
Yes.
On Rossum.
Yep.
You've heard about Manna's Storehouse in Ohio.
Yep.
All these different farmers, all these different groups basically lost. And we were the first group in the nation to come out the winner on the other side of an enforcement action like that.
Hmm.
At that point in time. The great news is now there's been lots of winners like Vernon Hirschberger and others. And so we came out the winners. I got involved with more activism on the national level, in terms of I was one of the people who went to Pennsylvania to illegally transport raw milk from Pennsylvania to the footsteps of Mordor, there in Silver Springs, Maryland, at the gates of the FDA. We took raw milk illegally from Pennsylvania to the gates of the FDA in Silver Springs, and held a basically protest rally where we distributed raw milk in violation of the federal raw milk interstate ban right in front of the FDA. We called Sheehan and the FDA for months in advance. We called them, and my friend Max Kane, who made the phone calls, recorded the phone calls and put them on YouTube. And for months we called letting them know the day we would be there, and the only thing that greeted us was like 30 Department of Homeland Security vehicles.
Uh-huh.
But Sauron would not come down from his tower, I'm afraid. there was no attempt at a soiree or some sort of engagement. So I began to get involved with stuff like that and helping other small farmers. I was asked to become a board member for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, and I served as a board member, I guess, for about 2 or 3 years. And last fall, they asked if I would consider becoming executive director. So I've stepped down as a board member, and I now serve as the organization's executive director.
Excellent. That's great. I'm glad to hear that transition has happened. Obviously, you've done a lot regarding this issue, and I want to start off with a kind of a philosophical question that I'm sure you have a word or two to say about it. And that is this: so why do governments? When I say governments, I'm talking all the way down to the HOA, to the local, to the state, to the federal government, why do they insist on getting in between the consumer and food or the farmers? Why is this happening?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a few different reasons why. You know, at the HOA level, it's more just the Dolores Umbridges of the world, if you've ever read the Harry Potter books.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this character, I believe she is in the fifth book, and she, to a T, describes the kind of people who end up in those kind of positions generally, where they are people who really think they should be able to tell other people what they can do with their bodies and their property and this, that, and the other. And they really think they're doing you a service by it. There's a great quote by C.S. Lewis, I think it's in God in the Dock, where he talks about the worst kind of tyranny is when the tyrant thinks he's actually doing it for your own good.
Yeah. Wow, yes, that is so true.
You know, and that is, and so a lot of those people, that's just where they're coming from. They're the kind of people who not only do they delight in bossing and busybodying other people's lives, but they actually think they're helping the world by doing it,
yeah.
Which makes them twice as dangerous. You know, as you move up the food chain of government and governmental power, you know, the people really high up are always looking for people like that who they can fill bureaucratic positions with.
Yes.
Because they're the perfect people to get in those positions to then do the dirty work for them. But higher up, you know, it really comes down to government officials protecting their corporate buddies from competition.
Yeah.
So when you look at who fills the shoes at the FDA, at the USDA, who fills the shoes at a lot of state health departments and other places, well, it's all of the buddies of the biggest agricultural companies in the nation and the biggest pharmaceutical companies and the biggest food processing companies. I was watching a video this morning on why we buy cars the way we do in America. Like, why do you have to go to a dealership to buy a car?
Right.
And it's because the people who wanted to sell cars got the state governments to write protectionist laws that make it so you cannot buy a car anywhere else. And in return, in many states, as much as like 10 or 15% of the state revenue comes from the tribute these dealerships pay for that protection. You know, it's no different than the mafia.
Right.
You know, the mafia comes to your business and the mafia says, give me 15% of your profit and I'll break the ankles of anyone else who wants to open a soup shop on this street.
Yeah.
Except this is legal.
Except for, you know, my joke about the government is, you know, it's basically the mafia, except for the mafia provides efficient and cost-effective services.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so that's, you know, philosophically, there's a lot of protectionism going on. And I also just think, you know, as Jefferson warned, the natural inclination of governments is to expand and for liberty to retreat.
Yep.
And especially for governments to want to act more and more like religions.
Yep.
Yeah, well,
because in world history, meddling with food is something only religious institutions generally have done. And so when governments begin to get involved with food, you know they're no longer secular as much as they claim. They became religiously oriented when they want to declare what foods are clean and unclean, what foods you should and should not eat.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. You know, it's kind of scary, but if it wasn't for organizations like yours, Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, governments would walk right over us. No doubt in my mind. You know, it's just kind of like HSLDA in homeschooling. Local governments, state governments, federal government would walk right over us as citizens if it weren't for organizations standing in the gap. And so, I think your organization is definitely doing that.
Yeah, because you're using intimidation tactics and the threat of jail and fees and all of that to control people. And if we don't have legally someone standing in for us, because we don't, you know, it's hard to navigate all the legalese and all the laws that are there. And when you've got just like what happened to you, a raid coming in, Right. You're afraid.
It's swarms of officers. I've heard that somewhere.
Yeah,
before.
Have came to eat up their substance.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But so, you know it is. Well, and you know, it's good for listeners to realize, like, there's obviously high-end stuff like that that we do where you're raided or you end up in court like a Vernon Hershberger or like a Alvin Schlangen or a Mark Baker. But I'll read you a little quick story from even a much lower level thing. So this is something I got in my email just a week or so ago from a member of the organization. And so they're farmers in Maryland. And so they had a state of Maryland Health Department official come to their poultry processing facility and started harassing them. So we have a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week hotline number for members where you can call. And within 10 minutes, you will have an attorney on the phone with you to help you.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so they called our emergency hotline. They're given some basic instructions. A few minutes later, Pete Kennedy, who's our president and one of our attorneys, called them back. He dealt with the health department on behalf of the farmer, and the issue was promptly resolved before it ever got out. And that's the great thing about what we do. Is oftentimes we can help you before things get really bad.
Yeah, that's key.
And I'm always telling people, this is why, you know, you can't buy car insurance once you're in a car accident. We need you to become members today.
Right.
So that we can help train you on the front end, and so that when something does happen, you can call that number immediately. And we can serve and help you to keep a situation from spiraling out of control.
Right.
Well, absolutely. We're members now of Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund and plan on continuing that. And we obviously advocate it.
Added a homesteader class of membership.
Yeah, I saw that. That's excellent. And we kind of put that information out as well.
So speaking of all of this, so what currently are some things that you're working on or some cases that you guys have taken on that you're battling right now?
Yeah, well, we have a case going on in Texas right now, the Hooley case.
Is that the Fort Worth fiasco?
Yeah, that's the Fort Worth one. And I wish I would have had a chance to talk with Pete this morning. I could find out what the state of that case is because it might have wrapped up yesterday. In terms of trying to think, what are the cases at the moment? I know we have quite a few cases in motion, and then there's a number of cases that are under appeal.
So tell us, why don't you tell us a little bit about this raw milk case, even if it's taken care of, but what kind of, you know, what are you dealing with that, or what was the issue there?
I think in a nutshell, and we'll have write-ups on our website about it, that we'll be able to really be, because you know, when I'm talking on a radio interview, I always want a caveat. Since it's our lawyers who take care of the cases, we usually put stuff on the website to make sure it's really accurate. So if you're listening and then you find out a detail here or there isn't 100% right on, that's what our website is for.
Got it.
Because these are complex cases.
Yes.
And so when I'm giving kind of a broad brushstroke of what a case looks like, I just want listeners to beware that they want to double check. But in a nutshell, Texas has some convoluted raw milk laws about, like, you can get raw milk, but you can only get it at the farm. And if you don't get it at the farm, you don't want to drive to the farm, you have to agree to retain an agent to go to the farm for you.
Okay.
To buy the milk for you at the farm. It's this is very convoluted legal framework, and the city of Fort Worth felt that however this farmer was doing it did not meet that convoluted framework. And so the farmer decided to challenge them on that. Texas is one of the more confusing states raw milk-wise.
Gotcha.
It's really ironic, given that it's supposed to be like a really free Republican state.
Right.
but it has really bad food regulations and food freedom regulations.
Yeah, I know. We hear that all the time, and we just shake our heads like, really? Because all we're hearing from Texas is, well, there's lots of issues cropping up in Texas regarding freedom. I mean, it's people, but they still think, oh, it's the Republic of Texas, and, you know, I'm going to move there. It's like, well, okay, but they have their problems too, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, we have that case going on, and I think we have a case going on up in Minnesota. The nice thing is we've been trying to, we still do litigation in a heartbeat when it's necessary, but we've been moving towards doing more and more preemptive work at the state and federal level. So one thing we've been working on that you can find out about on our website is what is known as the PRIME Act. So this is Congressman Thomas Massey, who lives just north of me in Kentucky on the other side of Louisville.
One of the few good ones.
Yeah, one of the few good congressmen. He's also a farmer, homesteader. He lives in an off-grid house, solar-powered. He built a wallapini on the side of his house.
Nice.
He raises pastured beef, and he's a congressman. He's like a walking paradox. the first time I met the guy was at Stanton in Virginia, because he was there to speak at our food freedom conference that we put on in Stanton, not far from Joel Salatin's farm. And, you know, I walk up to introduce myself, and he goes, hi. He goes, I'm Thomas Massey. And he looks at me, he goes, do you need some eggs? I'm like, I'm a farmer. Like, people don't offer me eggs. I offer them eggs. I'm like, I really shouldn't say no to this guy. Like, he's a congressman, and he's one of our major speakers. I'm like, yeah, sure, like, we could use some eggs. He's like, oh, good. He's like, my wife will kill me if I get back home and I still have these eggs sitting in the back of my car. We go down to his car in the parking garage, and he pulls out of the back seat a couple mixed dozens of chicken and duck eggs.
Nice.
And he's driving like, you know, he's also driving a Mad Max over Thunderdome car, it looks like. You know, just like an old red beater of a car, huge pro Second Amendment stickers on the back, while he's handing me pastured chicken and duck eggs.
Nice.
You know, it was just like, I was like, I'm going to get along well with this guy. So Massey, though, you know, if you were to transport yourself back to the early 1960s, you would have almost 20,000 butchering options in our nation.
Right.
At a time when I guess we had roughly half the population.
Yeah.
And in the late 60s, I think it was 1967, the government introduced a bill that would make Orwell proud.
Yeah.
It was the Wholesome Meat Act.
Oh, boy.
The Small Business Administration put out an analysis on what they thought the impact of this legislation would be on the beef and other meat markets in our nation. Because at the time in 1960, the beef, poultry, pork markets were highly diverse, very competitive places.
Right.
They basically said that this legislation would be the equivalent of a hurricane, like a class 5 hurricane hitting the beef butchering processing industry.
Centralizing it, of course.
Well, so now what do we have 30 years later? Well over 3/4 of all beef eaten in America is controlled by 3 companies.
Wow.
Yes.
And that's the same also for pork and chicken, roughly.
Yeah.
So almost all of the meat consumed in our nation is controlled by a handful of companies who were empowered by this single piece of legislation that supposedly protects consumers.
Right, yeah. By limiting choice.
Sounds like the Food Safety and Modernization Act.
Well, we'll talk about that in a moment because wait till you hear what's going on there. So, you know, so this Wholesome Meat Act, we went from almost 20,000 butchering options to now we have less than 3,000.
Wow.
Yeah, the centralization of anything is not a good thing.
And so Massey, so he was at our first Food Freedom Conference, and Massey and our President Pete Kennedy and Senator Frank Nicely, who's a state senator in Tennessee, and some other people had some discussions about where we could try and find chinks in the armor of the industrial food system. And they came up with this PRIME Act, because right now, if you try and sell a pork chop to your neighbor that you butchered on your farm, you will go to the state pen.
Right.
You know, it's a crime to sell a pork chop to your neighbor.
Right, which is ludicrous on the surface, but yes.
Oh, yes. You know, to do something that people have done for all of human history. But, you know, I mean, prisons are getting empty with the drug war winding down finally, and so we need to put someone in them.
Right.
So it's the food war.
Yeah. And so, you know, you got to keep the prison industrial complex humming along, making profits.
Right.
Yes.
And so the PRIME Act would give states the ability to allow people to go back to doing what they've done for all of human history.
Yeah, and I've read a little bit about the PRIME Act, and I'm obviously supportive of it. I think it's great. But isn't it sad that we have to create law to give people freedom?
Oh, I mean, you're preaching to the choir.
I know.
The fact that the Homeschool Legal Defense Association or the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Association has to exist in the first place is a sign of our failure as a nation and as people.
Yes, yep. Totally agree.
And acknowledging that failure is where we have to start. Because until we are willing to admit we have a problem, then there is no fixing the problem.
Well, and I think that the information that you guys put out, along with other you know, local co-ops and local food networks, is starting to get that message out to at least people in smaller regions that are willing to start questioning their local laws and their state laws.
Yes.
And so that's what we're doing at the federal level. At the state level, you probably heard about the Wyoming Food Freedom Act.
Yes.
That was one of our members, Frank Wallace, and a bunch of other people working together in Wyoming. And we stand behind and help support efforts like that in many different ways. So when you donate to our organization or you're a member of our organization, some of those monies are going to grassroots legislative efforts to get bills passed in your states
that
will protect your rights and give you greater opportunity to be able to make a living off of your land, off of your homestead, with less interference and less, you know, just all of the nonsense that you face.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, you had alluded to something interesting about the Orwellian Food Safety and Modernization Act. What were you talking about?
Well, they finally started releasing portions. So this is another sad thing about our nation. Congress is supposed to write the laws. But instead, what Congress often does is they write a law that gives an unelected bureaucratic agency the ability to actually write the law.
Right.
Right.
And so that's what the Food Safety and Modernization Act was. It was basically a blank check to a number of government agencies to do whatever the heck they wanted to the food system. And so government agencies are required to go through what's known as a rule writing process, where they get input from the public, which, you know, it's all dog and pony show.
Mm-hmm.
It's there to make people think they actually have a say when they don't really have a say.
Right.
And so they just released a couple weeks ago just the produce rules on the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Oh, boy.
and it was 750 pages.
Oh, wow. My word.
Just for produce.
Oh,
holy
man.
Mackerel. And that's the safe stuff. When you get into the meat and the dairy, boy, I can't even imagine how deep that's going to go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so small farmers and people who are trying to make money feeding people could easily face 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 additional pages of regulation.
Jeez.
On top of all of their state, all of the existing federal, you know, my hunch is that our food regulatory code probably is more extensive even than our tax code at this point.
Wow.
Which is pretty extensive.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, you know, and already nobody in the world can. I think there's a study done that showed something like 2/3 of IRS employees cannot actually comply with the IRS tax code.
Yeah. It's
like, you know, basically all of us are criminals when we file our taxes, because there is no way to file your taxes correctly, because the law, my accountant here in Kentucky a couple years ago when I was setting up my LLC pointed out that the way the Kentucky LLC law is set up is everybody who starts an LLC violates the law. Because the law was so poorly structured that you can't file a return. It's something like you can't file a return until you have an LLC, but you can't have an LLC, but you can't, like, it's just like this circular thing where you can't do A until B, but you can't do B until A.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So you just have to choose which part of the law you want to violate when you start.
Gotcha. Just madness. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah.
You want to shift gears here just a little bit and talk about some poultry. I want to move to poultry just a little bit and how all that stuff interacts with the state law. So, Monica, you were saying that as far as Idaho is concerned?
Yeah, with Idaho, it's a complicated. I was actually doing some research trying to figure out, can we raise and process poultry on our property and sell it to consumers legally? And are there exemptions? And so as I was going through everything, it looked like it was then falling under federal law, but then it also said something about the local. So how do we navigate all the complexity of the law just as, you know, as local farmers?
Yeah, well, again, that's why we started the organization, because if you're a farmer with a question, you can call our office, you know, 5 days a week during business hours, and we will be able to answer those questions.
Okay. Yeah, because it really gets confusing.
Yes.
And, you know, one thing we're going to start doing in 2016 is we're going to start four members having a series of basically short 30-minute podcasts that are very focused on understanding cottage food law, understanding on-farm butchering and processing, understanding zoning and right to farm, so that over time, you as a member, after a year or so, you will be much more equipped and comfortable to navigate the tangle and thickets that you have to walk through, and to do so with confidence and to keep yourself out of trouble. But to get back to poultry, so the way poultry is set up, poultry is treated differently than beef and pork and other larger animals. And so poultry is its own kind of regulatory black hole.
Okay.
The way poultry works is when the poultry regulations were introduced, the federal government had an exemption that allowed up to 20,000 birds to be butchered on farm and sold directly to consumers.
Okay.
So that's what's known as the federal floor. A state can be more strict, but not less strict than the federal floor.
Okay.
So some states, like Virginia, I believe, just adopted the federal floor.
Okay.
You can do 20,000 birds on farm sold direct to consumers.
Right. Okay.
Whereas some other states have adopted more stringent, basically regulations and standards. And every state is different.
Got it.
And so you have to figure out what does your state require. But in no state are you allowed, because of the federal rule, you know, to sell chickens to a restaurant that hasn't gone through a USDA inspected facility. You know, I think in some states might allow you to sell them at farmers markets, even if they're butchered on farm. And then just start going down this highly complex web of not only do you have to worry about your state and federal regulations, but then also, you know, your local farmers market. Are they following what the state says, or do they have their own set of regulatory things you need to comply with? Because there's some states where raw milk sales are legal at farmers markets, but there's some farmers markets that won't let the farmers do it because of concerns of reliability or what have you.
Gotcha.
And so again, that's why we have a slew of attorneys whose specialty is knowing and reading and understanding food law across the country.
Okay, got it. Yeah, that makes a lot. That helps a lot, actually. Here in Idaho, we have different zoning board, health boards. Mm-hmm. There's like six of them in Idaho, and we're still working through that process. We know there are some exemptions, and in this last year, we did our own processing, but we also processed for customers. And as long as we stay under 1,000 birds, you know, we're legal to do that here. But again, we're still navigating it, and not really 100% sure if we're following all the regulations. We're probably not. We're working on it.
Sounds complicated.
It is. Hey, let me ask you.
Well, that's the thing. There's a great book written by a guy called, I think it's called like 3 Felonies a Day. And he's a legal guy, and he basically points out that the average American commits 3 felonies a day, not even on purpose, but the number of laws and regulations that we're supposed to comply with basically renders all of us criminals.
Yeah. Yeah, if we just need to sit home and watch the NFL and stay glued to the TV, then we'll be fine.
Yeah, and they can start shipping you Solvent Green.
Right, right. Give us our daily dose of Soma. And we'll be good.
Yeah, so it's really very challenging for me, you know, just to realize that even if I try to comply, it's really a hopeless endeavor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. Hey, a question for you. How about meat rabbits? Where does that fall in this whole myriad of regulations and rules?
You know, meat rabbits are one of those murky areas. From what I've seen, I am not really exactly how that works out. So I think it falls to the states, and I believe the states are all over the map in terms of what happens with rabbits.
Okay, so as far as you know, there's no federal oversight of meat rabbits?
I would imagine because the industry is almost non-existent and
right,
so
it's not
small.
Nearly
there's
as
not
big
that
as poultry.
Competition that we'd be dealing with. So there's not much money in it.
Yeah, because if you Google meat rabbits, it looks like every state has, Washington State Department of Agriculture has a whole PDF handbook just on meat rabbits.
Wow. Got it.
And again, this is where, to sell and process rabbit, you must have a Washington State Department of Agricultural food processor license. To sell and process rabbit, you must have a Washington State Department of Agricultural food processor license. Mm. And so it looks like in some states it's highly restricted or outright banned. And then you have to go to your local health department and get permits. It looks like quite the quite the exciting endeavor.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, our daughter, who's 15, she just started a rabbit tree, and she also has a videography business. So, you know, we're big into entrepreneurship here.
Yep.
And, you know, but again, we've got to give her guidance, and we're starting to walk down that whole road. I mean, we obviously do meat rabbits ourselves for our own food, but, you know, she wants to be able to turn around and sell it, because if you look out there, I mean, for naturally raised rabbits, there's a pretty decent little niche market out there.
Yeah, and just looking through, like, it looks like in West Virginia, it looks like you probably can raise and slaughter up to 1,000 on farm.
Oh.
And so again, this is why we have attorneys, because it is such a thicket.
Yeah.
And it's great. You know, we try and tell farmers, it's great before you get, before you start running down this, you know, you might think an enterprise is great financially or farm-wise or for whatever land and infrastructure you have, but you also have to be sure that that enterprise works legally.
Yes.
Right.
Because we actually am friends with a couple who, they had a great business plan doing value-added meat processing in Virginia. And they had access to a number of great farms, and a number of great farms were going to support them because they wanted to see some of their meat be value-added processed into things that they couldn't get value-added processed. And it all fell apart because they just had not done enough legal homework.
Right.
And so they ended up spending tens of thousands of dollars only to get nothing for it because they never got to a point of compliance.
Gotcha. No, you're right. That is a great point. There may be a great business idea, even with a great business plan, but if the legal framework is not negotiable, then, you know, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I know in Montana, they're not allowed to sell raw milk, but in Idaho, we are. So that would limit what they could do in Montana versus in Idaho. And here, cottage food laws are a little more restrictive than Montana.
Right. So it's just this catch-22 thing.
Yeah, it's all over the place. And you know, that's why we're so encouraged by the Food Freedom Bill in Wyoming and the food sovereignty ordinances being adopted in Maine. Because we're hoping people in other states will be able to find members like you all in a state like Idaho and find sympathetic legislators and begin to carve out spaces for the free flow of food between consenting partners.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, because in a nutshell, that is our mission. You know, our mission as an organization is any person should be able to get any food they want from whatever producer they want to get it from.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that just makes complete sense.
And it allows for more options for the consumer. So they can actually become more informed on the health issues within their own food and choosing, you know, you raise the animals humanely. I like the way you process them. And so I want to go to you. Rather than being forced to buy a commercial product where they can't know their farmer, they don't know how the animal's been treated or what they've been fed and how they were processed.
Yeah, well, and that's the irony, is like in Idaho, for instance, you all had that law passed, that ag gag law, that I guess was struck down as unconstitutional.
Right.
You know, but like the concrete walls and the lack of windows at butchering facilities, it isn't for the sake of the animals inside. It's to make sure that us eaters on the outside do not know what actually is going on.
Right.
Right.
And for the government to basically fearmonger, an industry to fearmonger about a food system that's highly transparent and localized so that, because one thing I always tell people is like things go wrong no matter what. You know, whether it's a local food system or an industrial food system, you're going to have bad people.
Yep.
You're going to have mistakes because you're dealing with humans.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, when a farmer in Kentucky who's feeding a buying club has something go wrong or releases a contaminated food, you know, you'll know within a day or so, you'll have traceability, you can pull things easily, you can isolate the problem and figure it out. But when you look at these foodborne illness outbreaks for these large corporations, like the ice cream one from this summer, you know, where they're closing plant after plant and they can't find out which plant is to blame and they're not really sure exactly which batches, or like the vegetable outbreaks, well, was it the cilantro or was it the spinach? And how is salmonella even getting inside of some of these things to begin with? You know, like we should be advocating and arguing if our concern is the safest possible food supply within reason, a decentralized, localized, farm-to-fork kind of traceable system is exactly that.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. It's much easier to trace where something went wrong if it's local and highly local, just like you said.
Yeah, and it's going to affect a smaller group of people.
And that's the beauty. Like, it's more traceable, and at the same time, when something does go wrong, you don't have 17 states and 3 million pounds of hamburger.
Right.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's ludicrous. But again, the gut, you know, their idea is, well, if we just chlorine bathe it a little more, or if we just irradiate it twice, you know, more rules will somehow make a broken system finally function right.
Right, and then you're taking in all those additional wonderful chemicals into your body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's insanity.
Yeah, but that toxic food is much safer.
Well, and what, that's the irony. Like, take store-bought chicken. Which, you know, like in Kentucky, there's only less than a handful of places, I believe, that a farmer can take chickens to be processed in a USDA-approved facility.
Oh, my word. It's terrible.
For the whole state. And so, but Consumer Reports a few years ago did a study on grocery store chicken and found that like 3/4 of all grocery store chicken is contaminated with pathogenic bacteria, and of that 75%, half was contaminated with multiple strains of antibiotic-resistant pathogens.
Oh, wow.
And that is after that chicken went through a USDA, FDA-inspected, chemically sanitized government inspector. You know, the bacteria did not care that there was multiple government inspections for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, the bacteria were undeterred. And so it's insanity to me that they think, well, what we need is just more inspections and more chemicals.
Well, yeah.
You know, so that when the chicken goes through the cross-contaminated fecal bathing units, somehow chlorine will undo the fact that these chickens have lived their whole lives, you know, beak deep in their own feces and urine and overcrowded.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It is. And that's one of the things that we really like about, you know, farming, you know, having meat. We know where it's been. We know how it was treated.
How it was raised.
How it was processed,
yeah.
which, you know, we have control over, and it's very sanitary, and we get that meat taken care of so quick, and it's a blessing to have meat like that. And if we weren't able to raise our own, it would be wonderful to be able to go to a local farmer and see how their animals are treated and processed. And for the government to step in between the consumer and the farmer to stop that, you know, that local trade is wrong. It's wrong.
Absolutely. Well, hey, John, I think we'll go ahead and stop here. Once again, thank you so much for being on. Would you tell us just a little bit about how people can join Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund?
Great. Well, you know, we have a website. It's www.farmtoconsumer.org. There's a place there. It probably says join or become a member. You can click on that, go through the membership process. We're going to be overhauling the membership process here in a month or so. And that'll be real exciting. It'll be a simpler, more streamlined process. But if you don't want to wait, we encourage you not to wait because we need your support now, not later. You know, we're a 501c3. We don't get money from the government. We don't get money from corporations. Our support comes from members and individual donors and small independent companies and buying clubs who want protection, want the services we offer, and want to see their children have greater food freedom than they enjoy now. And so you can make a donation to our work. We'd love to have you as a member. Or if you just want to call our office and find out more about what we're doing and how you can be involved, there's lots of different ways to support what we're doing.
Absolutely. That's great. We're members. We advocate it. And there's a category for everybody, from consumer all the way up to the CSA.
Well, and that's the great thing. Like, most of our members are consumers. We do have a lot of farmer members. We do have a lot of homesteader members. But I think the thing is, everybody eats.
Right.
Not everybody farms.
Right.
And so it's really the consumers in the long run who are going to have to stand up to protect the people who are providing food to them.
Right.
Absolutely. Our verse for today is from James chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not to be so. And our shout out for today goes to Benjamin in North Carolina. Thanks for listening.